Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest today is the commissioner of the Baltimore City Police Department, Michael Harrison. While the murder rate in our city remains intractably high, crime in several other categories is trending down. We've had many fewer rapes, robberies, and auto thefts this year. But police in Baltimore and beyond still have a long way to go in gaining the trust of the communities they serve. Just yesterday, the Baltimore City Board of Estimates agreed to $10.5 million in settlements for abuses committed by the Gun Trace Task Force. As a new mayor takes office promising a reimagining of the city's approach to public safety, Commissioner Michael Harrison joins me to explain the role of the police in that strategy. Midday starts after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you're with us on this chilly but very pretty sunny day here in Baltimore. My guest today is Baltimore City Police Commissioner Michael Harrison. The coronavirus has crippled businesses across the city and forced many to close, but it has had no appreciable effect on the number of murders in our city this year, which stands at 294 as of today. Yesterday, the department announced the arrests of 14 people who are believed to have been involved in several carjackings in the Northwest District. And on October 29th, Judge James K. Bredar said in a quarterly hearing about the consent decree that, quote, "there now is solid leadership in the police department, and there is beginning to flow real and substantial progress in achieving consent decree objectives." This is from the judge charged with overseeing the implementation of the consent decree between the Department of Justice and the police department. It was seen as a clear message to incoming Mayor Brandon Scott that he should not contemplate changing police commissioners. Well, Mr. Scott has so far indicated that Mr. Harrison's job is safe, at least for the moment. But the mayor-elect has indicated that the BPD will likely face significant budget cuts, and he campaigned on a promise to reimagine the city's approach to public safety. We'll take calls for the commissioner a little later in the program. To send us an email, our address is midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. Commissioner Harrison joins us on Zoom. Commissioner, welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you for having me.
As has been my custom since you've come on the last couple of years, I want to ask you first about Sergeant Isaac Carrington. He was shot in the course of a robbery when he was off duty in his home back in August of 2019. What is his condition today?
Well, I think his condition is, I mean, he's in good spirits, but he's still not able to fully recover where he has use of his legs. And that's a prayer we continue to pray, that he would be able to make that recovery. I saw him not too long ago, was still in good spirits, at another funeral. But, you know, we all still remain prayerful and hopeful that at some point he can make a recovery. But at this point, you know, we've made an arrest in the robbery portion of the case, but not in in anything else. And so, you know, he's still a major part of our Baltimore Police Department family. And I really want to thank you for always keeping him on the front of your mind and in the ears of your listeners.
Yeah, because so often, you know, we read these stories and then they just sort of get engulfed and forgotten. But I do send, on behalf of all of our listeners, our best wishes to Sergeant Carrington. He had a street named after him in the 5600 block of Summerfield Avenue about a year after the incident occurred in which he was shot. So that's a nice honor. Appreciate that. How about COVID-19 in terms of the department? Are there a lot of officers who are either quarantining because they've been exposed, or people who have, been diagnosed positive with COVID-19. What's the effect on the force itself been for you?
We have had breakouts in the police department. We recently had a a couple of different breakouts, and we continue to see members of our department become affected. And yes, we have had to quarantine a number of officers. And as of, I think about a week ago, we had close to 100 officers that were quarantined. Doesn't necessarily mean that 100 were infected, but were quarantined because of potential, you know, actual or either potential exposure. But just about everybody who has become infected has become better and come back to work. We still have a number of people who are out right now infected in the quarantine number. And I can get you that total number in just a few minutes. We have one person to pass away. We have one person right now in critical condition, but just about everybody else has either recovered and come back to work or is in the recovery phase as we speak. And so that poses challenges for us, not just in the department, but in our workspaces as well, because we have to make major adjustments on how we work out of police stations and in police headquarters and working in buildings, changing the protocols to do much of the information sharing and communications outdoors. And then, you know, officers sometimes working in the same vehicle, you know, those protocols, we have to be really strict. And now we're doing inspections, daily inspections around the department to enforce not only the mayor's and governor's orders, but to enforce the actual COVID best practice guidelines for how we should operate in buildings and outside of buildings and in public spaces. And so we want to keep our people safe. So we have to inspect every part of the department every day to make sure we are complying in order that we can go out and then provide public safety to keep people safe and then enforce those ordinances and those directives and orders in the community as well.
Have you had much problem with that? The governor the other day in his press conference seemed none too pleased with the fact that so many bar owners and bar patrons in particular, bars and restaurants, were ignoring or just, you know, completely forgetting the guidelines about mask wearing and social distancing, et cetera, and calling on local jurisdictions to have greater enforcement. How would you assess the city of Baltimore's efforts to enforce and the efforts, the levels of compliance in places like bars and restaurants, which as of now, or perhaps it's Friday, can no longer stay open past 10 o'clock?
Well, I think by and large, most business owners have been compliant and following the directives. There have been a few where we had to take action. By way of what's called the Social Club Task Force, made up of members of the police department, but members of other city agencies, all part of one task force. And, you know, we've had to take action here in the city, but by and large, everybody is, or most people have been very compliant. And now that we've scaled back, you know, we're out there making sure that they continue to be compliant. You know, as we, you know, put those protocols on ourselves to make sure that, you know, we're compliant in our workplace, we're working to make sure people are compliant on a voluntary basis. We certainly don't want to have to go and physically enforce it, but really educate people on how to be voluntarily compliant so that we don't have to go in and take those actions. You know, it's already bad enough. So we think people here in the city have been compliant. We realize it's difficult, but we're not seeing what some are seeing elsewhere.
As we hear police sirens in the background, our guest today, Michael Harrison, he's the commissioner of the Baltimore City Police Department. We will take calls for Commissioner Harrison a little bit later in the program. Commissioner, I mentioned at the top of the show that there are several categories of crime that are down, not the murder rate, and we'll talk about that in a second. But one of the categories that is up is carjackings. There were 16 just last week. You busted a big carjacking ring, and you announced that just yesterday. Tell us what you found and what your expectation is about how this will attenuate future carjackings, particularly in the Northwest District.
I want to talk about that, but I do want to come back to the murder rate after that, because the murder rate is actually down. It's not down where we would like it or to an acceptable rate, but it is down. Shootings are down as well. And I want to come back to that. You know, we've seen a spike in carjackings, especially in the Northwest District and part of the city. But the police have been very proactive, very on top of it. over the past month, there have been almost 40 arrests made, mainly of juveniles. And over the past week and a half, we've made 14, I believe, and 12 of them have been juveniles in that one area. And so we put that out to the public to let the public know that, yes, while we're having them, and these youngsters are just kind of running about doing what they want to do unsupervised, and we are catching them in the act and making the arrest, and we're working really hard with our criminal justice partners to make sure that there are consequences. Now, we realize that many, if not all of them, have been released from jail, either with a small bail or no bail, and that poses great concern for us, because we would hope that, you know, they would be confined, because that is an act of violence. And we don't want them to reoffend. And, you know, more often than not, there are probably not resources available to treat and deal with them post-arrest and pre-indictment or pre-conviction, to keep them from reoffending. But we want to make sure that there are consequences so that we can deter that type of bad behavior. And, you know, because that is a crime of violence, and people are traumatized, you know, when guns are put in their face, they're robbed, their cars are taken from them, and some of them are physically attacked. But we wanted to show the community that we take it seriously and that we've made a bunch of arrests regarding these, and we will continue to do that. And we have deployment strategies put in place to help deter as much of it as we possibly can and apprehend as many as we can when they commit these bad acts. When it comes to murder, now the murder rate is down. As of this morning, we were down 12 murders compared to last year. But then last year was a crazy year where there were way too many. So this is not anything to brag about or tout, you know, or be happy about. We still are way too high. We still need to be way down. But when you look at the major cities across America, there's 69 major cities. I'm a part of the Major City Chiefs Association, meaning that there's a population of 500,000 or more, or 1,000 officers in a department there. Of those 69 cities, we are one of 8 cities that are down in murder. The other 10, one of 10 cities, the other 59 cities are all up in murder, some as much as 50%, and they're up as much as 85% in non-fatal shootings. This morning, we were down 51 non-fatal shootings. And we're down in every crime category. And most cities, and we're only one of 3 cities out of that 69 that are down in every category. The other 59 are up in most of those categories. So Baltimore is actually doing better than we will admit, and better than the news actually reports on many cases.
Well, as of today, in 2019, there were 306 homicides in Baltimore. And as of today, in 2020, there are 294. It does seem unlikely that we will finish the year with fewer than 300 homicides. And as you say, that's, you know, an unacceptable benchmark. But I wonder, you mentioned your work with these national organizations. You're on a group called the Police Executive Research Forum. What do you and your colleagues attribute the murder rates across the country staying as high as they stay? I mean, as you mentioned, there are 8 jurisdictions in which it's down a little bit, but it's still very, very high. Is there any particular reason? Is there any, you know, in terms of the COVID pandemic, are there other things that you're pointing to that say, because in some of these jurisdictions where it's way up, Philadelphia, New York come to mind, it's way up from being, you know, historically low. So why the uptick? What's going on nationally?
So we're not seeing what they're seeing. However, when I talk to chiefs, they're telling me a lot of it has to do with the COVID response and the adjustments that the police departments have to make in how we deploy and how we interact with people. And although many people are indoors, not as many people are outdoors, the bad actors who want to commit these crimes don't apparently care about COVID, because they're still out there and the victims are still out there. But that speaks to people carrying illegal guns, the drug trade, the competitiveness of it, and the retaliations that happen because of these bad acts. And this core demographic of people are still out there in spite of COVID, but the police had to make major adjustments to protect ourselves from people who are infected and to protect people from us if we could be infected. And because we've all made these adjustments, you know, perhaps the criminal element has taken advantage of it. We don't, this is all anecdotal, and this is just what chiefs are talking about when we meet. But the other chiefs are experiencing major increases in shootings, major increases in homicides, and few people are experiencing decreases or kind of remaining the same. And so although it's not, we're not ready to tout it or brag about it or celebrate it, we're just seeing something a little bit different here than everybody else is seeing. We still have a heavy deployment, heavy engagement, heavy enforcement, and we've modified how we interact with people and go into homes or choose not to because of COVID, but we're still making those cases and arresting people for illegally carrying guns, which is the key, Tom. To date, as of last week, we had over 1,100 gun arrests made, and we were only down 26 compared to the same time last year. So we're doing the same amount of proactive enforcement as we did last year, even though there are far fewer people on the streets of Baltimore. But the people who are out there are sometimes people who are some bad actors who are continuing to participate in this drug trafficking and drug purchasing and drug trafficking, and then the violence that's associated with it, and then there are robberies associated with it that have gone bad. And then there are retaliations to it, all of which we're dealing with. But many chiefs can't really put their finger on it. We're just all kind of dealing with it, trying to stop it.
Michael Harrison is the commissioner of the Baltimore City Police Department. We will have more with Commissioner Harrison on the other side of this quick break. You are welcome to join us. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR News station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the program tomorrow, it's the Midday News Wrap. We'll examine the status of several of President Donald Trump's legal challenges to the election with The Nation magazine's justice correspondent, Ellie Mistall. Plus, it's another edition of Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel, and Duke University sleep psychologist Dr. Jade Wu. We'll talk about the important link between sleep and maintaining a healthy weight. So that's all coming up tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Baltimore City Police Commissioner Michael Harrison. If you have a question or comment for the commissioner, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. So Commissioner, in July of 2019, you issued a crime plan that focused in large measure on what you called focused deterrence. Tell us how that strategy has played out in the year and a half since then. And, you know, for example, you mentioned in this carjacking series of arrests that you announced yesterday, there were 14 folks arrested for carjacking, many of them juveniles, and many of them released after their arrest. What happens to those kids? Where are they? I mean, the reasons they're committing these crimes are varied. Some of them literally are doing it to support their families. Others are doing it for other much less important reasons. But when a young person like that is arrested, charged with a crime and then released with no bail or very little bail, then what happens next? And how does that fit in to this deterrence strategy that tries to focus on the people perpetrating these kinds of crimes?
So thank you for that. Yes, we did, Bill, we did talk about focused deterrence in our crime plan, which is very much aligned with the mayor's vision of the incoming mayor's vision of a comprehensive murder reduction strategy. So focused deterrence really is about murder and shootings, not necessarily about robbery, but it's focused on murder and shootings and the small subset of individuals who are committing those violent acts. And it puts it that we would focus on five pillars. The pillars are prevention, intervention, enforcement, rehabilitation, and reentry. And it is about two things. It is about offering a pathway away from a life of crime by providing preventive measures and interventions and dealing with addictions, and then certainly rehabilitation and reentry, people coming out of prison, making sure they have skills and jobs and good housing and a means to stay away from a life of crime. And by offering and providing all of those wraparound services, we actually create a path away from crime, thereby changing the culture of violence in the city, because we're fighting against a culture and a way of thinking. And then for those who just are hell-bent on being violent and continuing that life, then there's heavy enforcement against that subset of individuals. And so it's a very focused approach using data and intelligence. We began trying to build it. It has been a long, hard road. It actually goes to the Board of Estimates next week or week after next, actually, to get approved for the technical assistance and the contractual help that we're going to have to help build that. And it's very much aligned with the incoming mayor's vision of comprehensive violence reduction and very targeted approach going after it. It's not fully built because we had to get quite a bit of philanthropic funding to support us and to offset some of the costs. We have done that with success, but now we're actually in the building process. We've identified the experts in the country who are going to be on the ground with us to help build it. We've already have a pilot program laid out in a particular area of the city to start. In the very near future, you know, we'll be happy to come on your show and really lay out how and where we started and what we're seeing. But right now, we're still in the building phase. And so although it's in the crime plan from mid last year, it's been quite a bit of a mountain to get it done, but we're here.
Well, you're certainly welcome back to talk about it when it's released and when it's up and running. Mayor-elect Scott has said that he has great sympathy for the movement for Black Lives and the protests that occurred here in Baltimore as well as around the country. When you hear the protesters in those gatherings use the term defund the police, and this is something that Mayor-elect Scott has also said he's sympathetic to and has predicted that there will be budget cuts to the police department and some monies allocated to other places in the city budget. What do you hear when you hear somebody say defund the police?
Well, you know, as a professional and as a over 6 years now as a police chief, what I hear is not what people sometimes think they're saying. What I hear is let's put money in other areas to provide services for people that we ask the police to provide, but other people are better served to do it regarding things like mental illness or homelessness and other things, maybe addiction. But what comes across is take the money from the police and then give it to someone else. You know, the downside to that and the unintended consequence is that many times there is not someone else who is actually ready to take it at that magnitude and at that time. You know, Tom, I give the analogy of a sports analogy of building a stadium. You know, we never tear down a stadium and stop playing a sport and then take another year or two to build a new stadium and then we start playing 2 years later. What we do is we start building a stadium while we continue playing in the old stadium. And when the new one is built, we'll transition into the new one. And then at some point we can tear the old one down because the new one is ready to handle the handoff. That's what I think is more important, that it is not about taking money from the police to give to someone else, but rather how and when, because there are problems that exist today that we have to handle today. And sometimes the other entity or discipline that we think should handle it is either not yet built or is built but not yet ready to handle it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week throughout the entire city. And so we have to figure out who's going to handle it, can they actually handle it, when they should handle it, and how much does it cost. And then at some point we can figure out, okay, well, the police department is doing a percentage less work. Perhaps if that is going to someone else, then we can have intelligent conversations about maybe we don't need as many officers or maybe we don't need as much money, which is basically the same thing. But to do it now without actually doing that has unintended consequences, because we cannot provide some of the services that we provide with those cuts. But you know what? We're sworn to protect and serve, and we will always do that. And we will always, regardless of those cuts, by the way, which, you know, there were, you know, over $20 million cut from the budget. And, you know, we're going to adapt, improvise, and overcome, and still give first-class service to the people of Baltimore. But sometimes those things have unintended consequences that we have to be aware of, especially when we're passing off work to someone who's not yet ready to handle it.
Baltimore City Police Commissioner Michael Harrison is my guest. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me at Tom Hall, WYPR. Commissioner, we did a program last week, I guess, about this AIR program, the aerial surveillance program that has been in a trial phase for the last 6 months. It finished at the end of October. This is a issue, as we found when we did this show, that has very strong advocates and very strong detractors. It's a contentious issue among folks in our city. What are your personal impressions of the program so far? And when do you expect to have the kind of data that you're looking for to make an informed decision about whether or not you want to implement it moving forward?
Well, thank you. That's a great question. And so we, you know, as you know, we went to the public with a midterm report from the RAND Corporation, one of four researchers that are helping us on efficacy and public support and, you know, all of those things. And the four research partners are RAND Corporation, New York University Law Center, Morgan State University, and University of Baltimore. And so the RAND Corporation produced the midterm findings that showed that there were slightly more increases in cases solved than cases not solved. But, you know, we had to look at a number of variables, Tom. One, when we started May 1st, it was supposed to be three planes flying covering 90% of the city. But we started a month late, and then we only started with one plane. And then 60 days later, we got the second plane. So the program was only at a third capacity for 60 days, and then only increased by a third capacity after that. And it only got the third plane in the last few weeks. And then the pilot ended October 31st. So of the flight hours, you have to look at what parts of the city were actually covered, and then what crimes committed at those times were actually captured by when one or two planes were actually flying. When you look at that number, it's actually a small number, but of that number, it showed a slight increase of cases solved, meaning we identified the perpetrator and made the arrest. But there's no way to tell that the detectives would not have been able to solve it later with a little bit more time, only that we solved it a little bit faster and the number was slightly increased. We're going to come back with more data, because although the pilot ended October 31st and the planes are not flying, the data is still being collected and analyzed, and detectives are requesting investigative packets that the vendor produces, and they use those investigative packets as leads, which points to other evidence, which helps them investigate with the aim of clearing and solving those cases. And so we wait for the final report from the RAND Corporation and our other research partners to give us a better indication. And I promised the community, and even on your show, that I would let our research partners and their data speak for the program. And I wouldn't offer my personal opinion, but rather only allow the data to speak for itself.
And do you have any sense of when that data will be compiled and available?
I think it'll be in the very near future. You know, they give us preliminary data, but we need to vet that data. And then, you know, they're still compiling, even though we ended the pilot flying phase October 31st, they're still analyzing it, and detectives are still requesting it. And, you know, if a crime is committed, we have 45 days to request the investigative packet. In our agreement with the vendor, we would delete the video after 45 days. And so I would imagine in the very near future, there'll be a final report of the pilot program, which would inform us all of its efficacy and its public support. You know, we aim to figure deterrence, but deterrence is extremely difficult to prove, because you can't prove what didn't happen. And so we look at cases solved, cases cleared, deterrence, and then public support. And I look forward to getting that and then going back to the public, even on your show, to talk about final results. And then, you know, the new mayor and I can sit down and have a conversation about what we think about the results and make an informed decision.
Yeah, of course, the mayor-elect has not been by any means a fervent supporter of the program so far. He's got serious questions about it. And the folks who oppose it say that, they oppose it for a variety of reasons. They're concerned about privacy, they're concerned about noise, they're concerned about a number of things. But fundamentally, they point to the issue being a relationship between the department and the public. That's what's going to bring the murder rate down. That's what's going to bring crime down. And these eyes in the sky are not, they're a distraction. They're not something that's going to fundamentally change the dynamic of policing in Baltimore. As you say, the data is still out. We don't know one way or the other what the numbers actually suggest. But when it comes to you mentioned earlier changing the culture of the street and the folks who are inclined to take a gun when they leave their house and use it when they're out on the streets. How are you doing, in your estimation, with implementing the consent decree and changing the culture of the department itself? We had this horrible settlement just announced yesterday by the Board of Estimates, $10.5 million to people whose constitutional rights were abused by a group that was in place long before you became the police commissioner, the Gun Trace Task Force. Those settlements are not finished. There are several more that could happen in the future. What's your take on the consent decree in general and the evolution of the culture of constitutionality and, you know, service that is not prejudicial in any way to any members of the community on behalf of the police?
Well, Tom, I think, you know, I'm confident that it is changing. And the reason why I can say that is because I can see it, because I've seen it before and I recognize it when I see it. You know, many people perhaps have not seen a cultural shift in the evolution of a police department, you know, but I have, and it's happening. And the judge, the monitors, the Department of Justice are validating that there is improvement. Now, we're not where we want to be. We're not perfect. We're not where we want to be. We realize we have and we acknowledge that we have a very long way to go. However, you know, we have stabilized leadership. We have stabilized the department. We have created new policies and protocols and training. And we have now trained all of our officers on the best practice, national best practice use of force, which, by the way, our policy has become a model across the country, and we're sending it to many cities who are asking for what does a good use of force policy look like, and the Department of Justice has approved ours, and we're giving it to people. Now we're training officers on stop, searches, and arrests to make sure everybody is prepared with what constitutional Fourth Amendment stops and searches really look like and how to appropriately handle that. And I can tell by virtue of the way we handle protests, you know, after the killing of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, what you saw across the country, you did not see here. You saw the police show extremely great restraint, acceptance, and tolerance, and you saw other departments, you know, really struggling. And so by virtue of that, we saw a very different department now than we saw in 2015, and we're seeing fewer uses of force, fewer complaints against officers. We're seeing more training, we're seeing more discipline, and we're seeing less litigation. So it is happening. It is slow, but the department is becoming the department we really want. We're bringing on brand new people, and our hiring has surpassed all last year's hiring. We surpassed last year in October, and although attrition has remained steady, hiring has improved. So people still want to be members of this department, and we are producing high quality recruits that are graduating from our first class academy. So although we're not where we want to be, we can see the infrastructure and the structure of the department being stronger and being improved. And we're on a pathway to being consent decree compliant in every area.
Michael Harrison is the commissioner of the Baltimore City Police Department. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. We will be right back.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. The surge of the coronavirus pandemic continues to accelerate. More than 250,000 people nationwide have died of disease related to COVID-19. The state health department announced that yesterday here in Maryland, more than 2,900 people were confirmed to have contracted the virus, far and away the highest daily number since the pandemic began. Baltimore City Schools announced just this morning that they will pause all in-person learning and meal sites during the week after Thanksgiving, anticipating that some families may travel for the holiday or assemble in groups in which viral transmission may increase. A reminder, health officials strongly urge all of us to limit the people we spend Thanksgiving with to those who live in our household. The CDC just announced this morning that they urge no one to travel for Thanksgiving. No one should travel for Thanksgiving. That's the recommendation of the CDC. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Baltimore City Police Commissioner Michael Harrison. As a poll by WYPR, the Baltimore Sun, and the University of Baltimore showed last spring, despite the crippling impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, crime reduction remained the top concern of city voters as they headed to the polls. Mayor-elect Brandon Scott has pledged to reimagine the city's approach to public safety. We're talking about what that reimagining might look like. Commissioner Harrison is with us until the top of the hour. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org, and you can tweet us at Midday WYPR. So, Commissioner, when it comes to data, and you're big on data, as well you should be, you and your fellow chiefs across the country, we talk about the data that you're anticipating from the AIR program, the surveillance program. I wonder, the other things that have been in place, things like ShopSpotter or the street cameras or the helicopters, is there any particular data about those programs, the blue light cameras, et cetera, the ShotSpotters, which, you know, detect gunshots and, you know, tip off police that a shooting may or may not have occurred at a particular location? Is there hard data, like the kind that the RAND Corporation and Morgan State and UB are compiling for the AIR program? Is there data about these other programs as well?
Yes, there's data. While I can't, you know, regurgitate it all verbatim for each one of them, there is data. For example, ShotSpotter, we know for a fact that it decreases response times from the time a person actually calls, where it goes through the operator to the dispatcher, then to the police. ShotSpotter picks it up within a few seconds, and then it's sent directly to the officer's departmental cell phone, which every officer has. And so we're responding to calls of shots within 1 or 2 minutes, as opposed to the 7 to 10 minute time it takes for it to go through the system and get to the officer. But don't forget, that call is coming from a citizen's cell phone at their home or wherever they are. It's not coming from where the shot actually occurred. So we're going to the place where the shot occurred and not to the area where the citizen called, which is very different. So we gather and we use that data. And it has helped us on some of the arrests we've made because of the faster response. When it comes to the camera system, well, of course, there are quite a few of our shootings, murders, robberies, and other crimes that are captured on video, and we use that video as probable cause to make arrests, and we use that as evidence against these individuals. And so the technology that's there, certainly none of it is perfect, and none of it alone can help us improve the clearance rates, but together with good investigations, they are all very important tools that the detective use. And the AIR program is yet just another tool. It's an investigative tool for detectives to be able to use to point to other evidence And it actually points to ShotSpotter and cameras that perhaps the officer would not have known or detective would not have known. For example, if there's a shooting or a murder in one part of the city, but the perpetrator fled and drove all the way to the other side of the city, well, the detective may not have known to look at cameras 15 miles away on the other side. However, the aerial surveillance program would, if it captured and followed that vehicle or that person, would point the detective to that part of town to actually look. So it becomes a tool that the officers have enjoyed and are using to help them in their investigations. And, you know, but once again, it's an investigative tool by itself. It can't clear any cases, and we can't make any arrests solely with the plane. There still has to be good investigations.
Let's go to the phones to James, who's calling from Northwest Baltimore. James, welcome to Midday with Commissioner Harrison.
Good morning, Tom and Commissioner Harris. I'm a 60-year-old African-American male. And until foot patrol is put in these high crime areas in, like, Northwest Baltimore, we've had several people shot at the same location with the police down the street, because the police do not go out and mingle amongst the people where they know there's a lot of a high group of number of people. And when you have a high number of people standing around all the time, there's a probability if somebody got a beef with them, they're going to shoot in the crowd. And the police know this, but they don't go foot patrol. Commissioner, if you do not put foot patrol in these areas, you are failing. You are a failure, because we know that's where the crimes repeatedly are. You got to do a better job with that. And our relationship with the African-American community is like an abusive relationship. And that's why you have no trust, because you don't listen to the people. So I'm sorry, you don't. You got to do way better than this. Thank you, Tom.
All right, James. Appreciate that. Emotional and certainly heartfelt criticism. It's not the first time you've heard that, Commissioner. Your response to our caller,
yeah,
James.
Well, first of all, I thank him for his passion. I thank him for his comments and criticism. You know, I welcome that. Just in our CompStat meeting today, you know, we talk about and we measure how much time officers are out on foot and are in neighborhoods engaging. And that is a part of the crime plan, and that is exactly what we do. There may be times where when you look, the officer is in a car doing something different, but we actually assign officers to do that. As a matter of fact, we want them doing it multiple times during the shift. Now, will you be at that moment witnessing it when you're there? We don't know, but that is something we certainly do, and we evaluate it every day and every week. And we challenge the commanders to increase it. And the caller is absolutely right. We have to engage with people. We have to break up these groups that are out there up to no good. But that's why we're training. You heard me say earlier in the show, we're in the process of training all of our officers on stops, searches, and arrests. Because we were conducting stops that were unconstitutional and we were walking and doing things in an unconstitutional way, we're now having to train everybody on the appropriate way to handle those groups, because many of our officers did not know, and some still don't. And so that's part of the training you heard me talk about earlier. We're about halfway training the 2,500 officers on the appropriate way to do that. The caller is right. That's what we have to do, and we have to do a better job of it.
The Inspector General for the Department of Justice issued a report that chastised the Trump administration for its failure to adequately check the practices of local police departments and contain the erosion of public confidence in law enforcement, the kind of lack of confidence that James, our caller, just voiced. This guy named Michael Horowitz, he said, one of the most pressing challenges the department has now, meaning the Department of Justice, is restoring confidence in policing after another year in which black men were killed by police in one high-profile case after another. The core reason that police are viewed so suspiciously by so much of the community has to do with these abuses that we read about all over the country. And that, in fact, people point to the several here in Baltimore as well, Freddie Gray, etc. How does that change if something that happens in Minneapolis or in Louisville is going to adversely affect people's impression of the Baltimore City Police Department? How do you act on that? What kind of training can happen with your police department that can counter that kind of criticism?
Well, I think we have to be courageous enough to have the conversation about what we saw, even if it's in another jurisdiction and somewhere else across the country. So it can be a learning and a teaching moment for us. And so that we can make sure that we have the proper policies, protocols, training, and practice so that we don't have that here and we can minimize those kinds of uses of force. And when things happen, we have the appropriate response to it, which is the second part. And so we just have to be courageous. And I encourage chiefs, we talk about it all the time, to go back and analyze those things with your department without being overly critical, but making sure we have the proper infrastructure so that those things don't happen in our departments. And when they do, we respond appropriately and take the appropriate action. You know, first thing you saw me do, Tom, I put out a video and sent it across the country the very next day, you know, right after George Floyd. And I put out a video to the members of my department about what the expectations were here in Baltimore. And so I just think good leadership requires us to really take a look at those things and not be afraid to talk about them and do everything you can to learn from that so that we don't repeat it here in Baltimore.
We have an email from Al who says, one way to look at what's going on with the increases in crime is that people are losing jobs, they're losing housing, they're getting sick, and they're getting desperate because of this unprecedented pandemic. So what action does the commissioner think needs to come from our elected representatives to make sure our citizens don't get desperate and turn to crime? And the reverse of that, which I'll add, is things like the LEOBR, the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. There's a movement to either eliminate it or change it substantially so that police officers are not as protected as they have been when they do, in fact, abuse their rights and their power. What sort of legislative remedies are you looking for from Congress and from the Maryland General Assembly coming up?
Well, I am working with chiefs and sheriffs here in Maryland to put forth recommendations on what we think we need as policing leaders to have more authority and autonomy in taking disciplinary action against members when they commit infractions of policy or violations of law. And we can take the appropriate disciplinary actions that citizens expect us to be with in real time. And so there have been conversations. We have been in working groups. We have been in discussions with the delegates and the senators in the state of Maryland. And then there's been a national body of work I work with the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Me and two other chiefs from across the country with three mayors were in a working group to put forth national recommendations on what policing should look like going forward and how we deal with this very thing that you just mentioned. And just yesterday, I started with the National Police Foundation in a working group. I'm the only police chief on this panel. With the National Police Foundation to do a similar product to put forth recommendations on the reimagining of police and what policing should look like and how leaders should have the authority to take the appropriate action going forward. You know, all these things are gonna be discussed in bills that are gonna be put forth and perhaps passed in the upcoming legislature. And, you know, we're making recommendations and, you know, in many ways we're aligned and we agree that there needs to be change. And so I think you can look forward to something new and to something different.
Baltimore City Police Commissioner Michael Harrison. Sir, thank you for your time and look forward to the next time that you're on. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Take care.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, reporter Ellie Mistel, the justice correspondent for The Nation magazine, will join me for the midday news wrap. Plus, we'll have another edition of Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle and Duke University sleep psychologist Dr. Jade Wu. We'll talk about the connection between sleep and dieting. Here and Now is up next after news at the top of the hour. And don't forget to check out the Daily Dose later this afternoon. That's WYPR's compendium of the latest COVID-19 news and other local stories. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. We'll talk again tomorrow.
You're listening to your NPR News station, 88.1 WYPR.